Maybe give us a little background on like, what is UPI? Maybe why was it created? Some history, some background, like whatever you feel like sharing.
So UPI was created as part of the India Stack, where the India Stack intended to bring about presenceless, documentless sort of digital financial infrastructure for the country. And as part of all of that, I think first was Aadhaar, where it was intended to be some sort of identity. And that created the paperless sort of layer. The UPI layer was created then so that you can make digital payments quickly with the form factor of like an email, right? And so with that in mind, it was created.
I'm really sorry, but what do you mean form factor as an email?
Like the UPI handle that we are given or that we can create, it was intended to be as simple as sending an email out to someone. That was how payments was thought of via UPI, right? So you just enter the person's email address or their UPI handle and just send payments as if you're sending an email, right? Some history before before UPI existed, right? There was net banking, which was a large portion of digital payments. Then came in your NEFT RTGS, which was a systems designed by RBI. NEFT is National Electronic Funds Transfer, which had a cap of a certain amount back then. This was 2013-14. Then came real-time gross settlements, RTGS, which were meant for larger ticket sizes, so 2 lakhs and above kind of ticket sizes that were enabled digitally. But for your everyday smaller payments, people were still using cash back then, right? And for commerce, just as Flipkart and the others were taking off in India, right? Digital payments still was very buggy, right? All your payment gateways were not able to process payments digitally very seamlessly. There were still trust issues with regard to paying online, which is why e-commerce companies released that innovation called cash on delivery, which was then sort of adopted by the rest of the world, right? But in order to for payment systems to become less buggy, to have a very high redundancy capabilities and things like that, IMPS was also then sort of brought in. And also just to close out on the pre-UPI stage, right? Whenever you wanted to make a payment digitally, you had to log into your bank's interface, enter in their bank details, the receiver's bank details. You had to get the bank details from your friends if you had to make payments to them. And there was always a little bit of worry, like, why is this person asking for the bank details? What if it gets lost? What if I'm robbed of my money by sharing these bank details via WhatsApp or something like that, right? And so to obfuscate all of those aspects of requesting for bank details, of requesting for phone number and all of those aspects, a simple UPI handle was created, which abstracted the requirement for those aspects.
So this kind of reminds me of PayPal. Would you say that there are any similarities between UPI and how PayPal works?
Similar, yes. But PayPal, the only difference was that PayPal was privately held, and therefore you had to create an account with PayPal and you were dependent on PayPal for security, fraud, and your account details, etc. But more importantly, I think PayPal or even alternatives at that time were very high in terms of their fees, right? You would pay anywhere from 3-5% to a platform like that.
But that's only in India, right? I mean, in the sense that you're talking about even for people, let's say we both are in the US and we are US citizens. For us, would you say that the fees would be very high? Or
I don't know what the fees would have been in the US at that time for PayPal, but I don't think it would have been less than 2% at all, right? Which is still pretty significant.
Because I know the international transfers were pretty expensive because I have done some international
transfers. Yeah, cross-border for sure. But I think just within the same country, the payment would still be very high. Because, I mean, US is still a country where MDR or merchant discount rates are fairly high, right? India and other emerging markets, starting with India actually, the merchant discount rates are close to zero or less than 1%, right? And so that made adoption of digital payments huge in that sense.
So you mentioned, I mean, so all this was thought around, if I'm not wrong, and stop, correct me if I'm wrong, is I think all of this was thought around 2008, 2009-ish. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So one thing which is confusing to me is a lot of the smartphone adoption kind of took place in the 2015, 2016 times when like Jio became like, when Jio kind of democratized internet for everybody. So yeah. I'm just curious as to like, did they have the foresight that smartphones are going to be huge in the coming, let's say, decade? And then they were like ramping up the infrastructure to kind of support that? Or was this supposed to be like a desktop thing and, you know, maybe an email thing, like a sort of an email thing where people would maybe log on to their desktop computers and then do these transactions? Did they not imagine smartphone taking over as they did, or could you do you have any idea of like how they were planning this out?
I can't speak to the folks that were planning it because I don't know what was going on in their mind. But it's important to know that RBI sort of hived off National Payments Corporation of India or NPCI as the retail payments body for the country. Right. It's supposed to be a non-profit, non-regulatory entity that creates these infrastructures for retail payments in the country, right? Before NPCI, RBI...
I'm really sorry. Could you maybe just detail on what is like retail payments?
Retail payments is payments like what you and I make to each other or we make to a merchant and things like that, right? It's not a company-to-company payment, which was what RBI's RTGS and NEFT systems were designed for, keeping in mind, right? For large value transactions, NEFT, RTGS were the default at that time.
So whenever I'm buying like my ginger tea from, let's say, Chai Point, and I'm making a payment, that's a retail payment.
That's a retail payment. Payments that you would make to your friend, that's a retail payment. Those kind of things.
Yeah, please go on. Yeah.
Low value, basically any low value transactions. That was the intended use case for that, right? It was just so that RBI was not the... So NPCI was created because RBI could not be creating those payment systems internally and maintain and make sure that the upkeep is there and all the systems were geared for fraud management, chargebacks, or whatever else that was created, right? So RBI's role is as a regulator, right? Not to build and maintain payment systems in the country, which was why I imagine that NPCI was created back then, right? I don't think anyone can say that they would have had the foresight that the smartphone will take off, that data plans will become so cheap or affordable and things like that. I think there was a trend in that direction, but the way it did and in the scale that it did, I don't think anyone could have foreseen something like that. But also, I think NPCI then started taking over the payment system development from RBI. So earlier, the National Financial Switch was also being maintained by RBI. That got taken over by NPCI. Then IMPS Rails, which was instant messaging. I can't remember the full form, but IMPS was taken over by NPCI. And UPI was built on top of IMPS's Rails, right? As a way to abstract away the requirements for bank account beneficiary details and things like that. But what I'm trying to get at is that I would imagine that it was just designed with the foresight that payments needs to be simpler in the country to reduce RBI's requirement for cash printing, right? And distribution and the logistics behind it and things like that, right? Because cash was, yeah.
I was going to ask you like is cash like is printing cash or like maintaining is that a big issue? Like, is that the reason why they were?
Well, it's not a big issue. The RBI has to do it either way. No society can be completely cashless, right? And therefore, the RBI would still have to maintain some levels of cash, because cash has inherent benefits. It's fast. There is no entity in the middle. When I'm paying you cash, for example, there is no entity in the middle to make sure that the that you receive the money correctly, right? So there's no processing fees, basically, is what I'm trying to get at. There is privacy between us. Nobody else knows that I've paid you that much, right? So there are inherent benefits of cash, which is why no society or no country in the world will ever be cashless, entirely cashless, right? So RBI needs to maintain a flow of cash. But the flow of cash and the volume of cash that will need to be there in the system, I would imagine that they would have thought, let's figure a way to reduce it while bringing on board the low value cash distribution in the country online, right? So you don't find as many, let's say, 10 rupees notes or 20 rupee notes or whatever those coins and all of that stuff, right? Just pay digitally. So I think it was all designed with that in mind to make our system cashless, but not entirely cashless.
So before moving on, one thing which really surprises me is when I think of the Indian government or when I think of like Indian institutions in general, I think of like incompetency or very low level of competence or not much interest and a lot of lethargy, you know, jo hoga dekha jayega, like we'll see what happens types discussions. So this NPCI and, you know, what has happened in the payments in terms of like the foresight that they've shown and the competency that they've shown and the success of UPI per se, that's been really... it's been amazing to watch. So has that kind of how have you thought about it? Like, you know, were you like when you're looking at these government institutions doing engaging with the public and engaging with the companies and, you know, trying to bring out more innovations, has that really like, you know, have you been shocked at the level of innovation or the kind of entrepreneurial spirit they might have shown? Has that occurred to you? Or
I can't say I'm shocked, but I think it wouldn't be fair to say that the innovation has come from the government institutions only. I think the government institutions back in 2008, 2009, I think the biggest credit they need to get is that they brought on board non-political individuals into the fold that helped them think in terms of innovation and privatization and public-private partnership and things like that. So I think one of the folks that they brought on very early on was Nandan Nilekani, right? Who then was the first, I think, chairman of UIDAI, which was the body that created Aadhaar. So bringing him on board really helped the government think from innovation, think from in terms of bringing in tech onto public systems and things like that, right? The other entity was iSpirit at the time, who really was the one who engineered this whole concept of the India stack, of bringing on board cashless, presenceless, paperless, kind of that whole stack of India stack that was there, right? So it was an amalgamation of a whole lot of things that just came together in the right way that changed the course of history for India. But I think the credit for the government institutions at the time was bringing on board private individuals to come and rethink how public systems need to be built from a tech first kind of perspective, right? And giving that freedom to those private individuals, not political individuals at the time. And so I think those are some of the things that really helped. And now we're all bearing the fruits of that labor back then, right? And that foresight or that innovation back then.
Understood. But I think going back to the history or background, I think in one of your articles, you do lay out another scenario where I think during that time, or I think during 2011, 2012-ish, I think there was a rise of companies like FreeCharge. And I think a lot of people were moving to these platforms because of maybe the ease of, I think, the prepaid transactions. That was also sort of motivation for these banks to kind of band together and, you know, form UPI. Am I making that case accurately, or maybe can you correct me if that case is not very coherent?
Yeah, I think if your question is how did UPI or NPCI come about to being, then potentially yes. I think, as I mentioned, right, the e-commerce wave was so strong in the country that the payment systems needed to up their game, right? it cards weren't as omnipresent as we as it is today. We all at that time there were barely any cards issued in the country or cards outstanding in the country. Banks, even from a debit card perspective, this is back in 2013-14, it wasn't as prevalent, right? Bank accounts, very few people were had trusted the payment gateway to be able to process that transaction and make sure that it's going to the actual beneficiary and not someone in the middle, right? So payment systems, because of the commerce wave or because of the e-commerce wave back then, payments needed to up the game, which is when I think the wallet or the prepaid instrument started becoming popular. Because with a prepaid instrument, you knew that if you were topping up your wallet with, let's say, 5,000 rupees, the maximum damage to your account, if there was a fraud or if there was a hack or anything, was that 5,000 rupees, not the entire money in your bank account, right? So people were starting to trust wallets in that sense. Second was the ease of use of wallets. One tap on your phone or on your account, and the payment would go through, right? So it was very simple. You didn't have to go through too many hoops. With your traditional payment gateway, again, back in 2013-14, you had to go through like several pages just to ensure that the payment was going through, right? Versus, again, a wallet is just one click and you're done. So the ease of payment, the speed at which the payment was going through, all of those aspects built trust. But then also, more importantly, the launch of QR codes by Paytm back then was a big sort of catalyst, in a sense, to bring on board digital payments even in the offline spaces, where everywhere that people would see that QR code, they would start paying, right, digitally, again, with the wallet. Now, the thing is that back 2014-15-ish, this was when the banks started losing out on their fee income. Because on a wallet, it was all free, and the banks wanted to make their discount rate sort of interchange income, right? But now over there, they weren't able to earn that discount, the interchange income. And more importantly, they weren't able to see the kind of transactions that were being made, right? From my bank account, the only thing that the bank or the card network was able to see is that I'm recharging my Paytm wallet or my FreeCharge wallet or my MobiQuick wallet with 5,000 rupees. Beyond that, what I'm using that wallet for, the banks didn't have any visibility on. So that data play for them started.
But even before that, they would not have that. They would not have had that data. No, I mean, was that a new
thing
for them?
They would have had. Yeah, because it's all from my bank account that the money was going. So the bank would know that I'm paying it at an e-commerce store, right? If I was paying online, they would know that I'm paying at a restaurant if I'm paying with my card, right? So the bank would know, because the POS device would be mapped to a certain code, or it's called an MCC code. And that code was, the bank would know that it is going to a restaurant or it's going to a pharmacy or it's going to whatever. So that data was owned by the bank, right? The bank would basically have my entire transaction history, right? The card network as well, if I'm paying with my card, the card network would have all that data as well. And that data play was a bigger play for card networks in India than the actual interchange income play for the card networks in India. And they were losing out on all of that income because they don't have visibility on the data or the transaction data that was being used. This was all back then.
Right. So just to make sure I understand this right, I mean, the data play is important here because, I mean, they're able to allocate credit for these individuals looking at their transaction history. Is that the right play there with the data that they gather?
With the data, it's more about which other types of merchants should I onboard onto my network? Am I being able to, so for a large bank, for example, they want to be at the merchant side, building out acceptance, as well as on the user side, building out the supply side of things, right? When a transaction is made with a bank, with the same bank on both sides, right, of the acceptance and on the payment side, they are not paying any interchange commission to anyone in the middle, and therefore owning that entire transaction. It's called an honors transaction, right? And therefore, the banks would wanted all of that stuff. Now, the reason why they needed that data was, sure, for credit purposes, to be able to say that, okay, I can use this for trying to analyze which credit, which product I can cross-sell to this person. But I don't think it was as prevalent back then because it wasn't so popular a notion to pre-approve loans or credit cards to anyone. Nobody knew that that could be done back then. So the data play was something else entirely at that time. There was a small part of it for credit, but more about how do I build out my acceptance network? What types of merchants should I bring on board? What are the aggregate use cases my users are currently using? Then the card networks would use it for which types of card programs I should run. Should I run a credit card program with an airline company? Should I run it with a restaurant aggregator platform? Those kind of things, just to make sure that they know what people are spending on and therefore how to build those card programs in a sense. So there were different use cases, but I don't think pre-approval of credit was one of them. Again, this was back then. It only started when fintech startups started pre-approving and saying that, hey, I have all this data, let me pre-approve a loan for someone.
Understood. So just to digress a little bit, in the sense that with the data play, with the data that banks have had, maybe, have you seen have you been satisfied with the innovation that the banks have made over the years, or do you think that they missed like a huge opportunity? With the data that they may have had, do you think they kind of missed out on a lot of things, or for their purposes or for the business that they were in, they did a fairly decent job?
Are you referring to back in 2013, 14, 15, or now?
Yeah, before. Around that time, but also even if you want to connect that to even today with the data that they have, do you think they're making the right use of data? Are they going into business? Are they tapping on business opportunities where it might be possible because of the data they've collected, or they're just leaving? Or do you think they're leaving the data on the table and they're not doing anything out of it?
It'd be unfair for me to say whether I'm satisfied or dissatisfied with how a bank has innovated. Because I think it's very easy for us to forget that fintech innovation in the country is less than 10 years old, right? But more importantly, banks have different incentives from fintech startups, right? In the wallet era, pre-UPI and all of that stuff, banks did feel the fire. And they weren't happy with that at all, including your card networks, right? Which is where I think some bit of that motivation came to launch UPI under NPCI, which was co-owned by a bunch of banks, right? It wasn't the only thing, but sure, it was one of the major things, right? But banks did feel the fire because they didn't have access to that data anymore. They didn't have access to the interchange income or any of that stuff. And so banks' incentives are completely different. And the reason I said that the fintech ecosystem in the country is less than 10 years old is because at that time, banks didn't really think fintech startups could be anything, right? All those fintech startups at that time were small little mosquitoes on a giant, right? Where a large bank in the country was just like, you know, what is this small little company going to do to my payments volume? I don't think they had the foresight to see that a fintech startup could take a large chunk of their payments volume in a sense, and therefore offer better experience and things like that, because it's a regulatory area, and who better than banks at regulation and compliance and all of that stuff. So that is one. Fintech companies were very small back then. Nobody would have imagined that they would have come to eat the breakfast, lunch, and dinner of these banks, right? So that was one aspect. The second aspect was also just that the bank's incentives, as I said, are different, and therefore they are living in fear of RBI in some sense, that if we do something that is too risky or has never been seen before, or there's no precedent for something like this before, RBI will come knocking on our doors and we might not have any response to that, right? So that is the RBI sort of looking over their shoulders is a big area for them to control the amount of risk that they take. And plus, they're all public institutions. the trust that consumers have in their brand is super important. You cannot just launch something frivolous and then lose the trust of that consumer. But more importantly, because if you lose that trust of the consumer, RBI will come knocking again, saying, you know, what are you up to? So there are a bunch of those things. The other thing also is that banks have 50 or 100 different other business verticals within that overall bank. Payments was maybe not one of their major verticals because lending is a large vertical for them to focus on. So they would focus on growing their housing loan portfolio or personal loan portfolio or whatever else, right? Why would they have considered payments as a large area for them to think of? So there are so many different reasons that it's very tough to pinpoint any one of them and say that, okay, banks are not good at this or not good at that, because their incentives are completely different from those of a fintech startup, right? Yeah, I can go on about banks and RBI and fintech startups and all of that stuff, but
So one thing that you mentioned kind of struck me, which was the fintech startups coming for the breakfast, lunch, and dinner of banks. In the sense, has that played out that way? I think I have also heard that collectively, even fintech startups have grown and even banks have grown. Is that the story, or has there been some cost that the banks have had to pay for the rise of fintech startups? Maybe.
Fintech startups did come with that attitude that, oh, we know our consumer better. We know how to build better tech, and therefore we will, you know, be better than a bank, right? All of us in the ecosystem, including me, have always thought we need to quash banks. Banks, the traditional banks in the country, have no space in the future, right? We need to make space for new companies that are tech first, that care about consumer, all of that stuff, right? Unfortunately, that was a wrong approach or attitude to come at with the fintech sector. And that's where I felt everyone in the ecosystem now has realized that it has to be a partnership. It cannot be, at least in India, this is what I'm saying, it has to be a partnership. It cannot be that I will come for your lunch. I will, you know, take away all your entire market share and things like that. Sure, there might be parts of that. But the reason for that partnership and why it's important is just because license, right? Licenses in the country are very tough to come by, and that's largely been RBI's mandate, and rightly so. There are, with financial services and in a growing, emerging country like India, you don't want financial services to be in the hands of frivolous individuals, for example, right? You want individuals in financial services that will be there even in the roughest of moments. And consumers need to be able to trust such brands and institutions with their livelihoods, with their investments, with their savings, and all of those aspects. Most of our financial institutions have been around for 15, 20 years, maybe 40, 50 years even, right? So consumers have come to know and trust those brands. But more importantly, because I think in India, you need that physical presence to showcase that even if things go wrong, here's my branch, come in and talk to us about it, right? That physical presence helps build trust in a way that tech just cannot, right? And all our tech startups that are saying that we are building the best consumer experience in financial services are missing the boat with regard to building trust in that consumer, right? If a consumer is not seeing that wherever they are going offline, it's very difficult to build trust in a pure digital setup. And therefore, how do you build trust? How do you convince the customer that my institution, my neobank, my payment gateway, or whatever else is going to be around for the next 15, 20 years, right? That is something that has been an evolution in everyone's thinking in the ecosystem. And therefore, while we would have started out saying that we are coming here to, you know, conquer financial services and who needs traditional banks, you don't need it. But I think it's needed, and that partnership is needed, and that evolution in thinking has come about now. There are ways in which banking can be better. There are ways in which lending can be better and all of those things. There are ways in which license approvals can be better, but it just needs to come from that angle of building trust in the consumer's minds and making sure that there is that partnership between licensed entities for RBI to get trust that these institutions, these people are going to be around for the long haul.
Understood. So banks are not going anywhere, cash is not going anywhere, and it seems like trust is also like a core factor where you're ascribing, even though these banks may be slow or, you know, they may not do their things, very efficiently as maybe some of the other online companies, but that trust has been so vital. They have, for multiple years, they've been able to gather that trust with the audience per se, and now they're kind of reaping those benefits, even though they're slow. You know, people are kind of hesitant to move to these new technologies. Understood.
Yeah. There are so many neobanks in the country today. Have you made any one of those neobanks as your primary bank account?
No, I'm using ICICI actually. So
you don't need to mention which bank you use. but the question was that our primary banking is till today, with after there being so many neobanks in the country, right? Till today, our primary account.
I'm so sorry. Just to backtrack. So, what is a neobank?
A neobank. Well, there are many interpretations to digital banks, challenger banks, neobanks, and all of that stuff. Digital bank or challenger bank is one where they have the license and they are building the entire banking business off their own books, A neobank is one that is partnered with a sponsor bank or a partner bank and building a better interface, better processes and things like that, on where the entire operations is built off book, but the experience is built by a new fintech company, right? So that's a neobank. And there are several of those in the country today.
So they don't particularly have a banking license per se, but they're able to provide financial services, but those services are kind of handled by, like, the transactions per se are handled by the core bank itself, is it? Is that fair?
No. So the think of it just as a layer on top of an existing bank where I, as a consumer, know which is the underlying bank that I'll be using. So let's say it's an ICICI bank, right? So me as a consumer, if I sign up with one of the neobanks, that neobank, let's say, is working with ICICI Bank, right? I will know that my bank account is still with ICICI Bank, but my interface or my mobile app where I'm managing all my transactions, where I'm sending off all my, say, my investments from, all of those aspects are managed by the fintech startup or that neobank.
Can PhonePe be called as a neobank?
No, because PhonePe is just a payments company.
Can you give me an example of a neobank?
Neobanks there's Jupiter, there's Fi or Epify, it was called earlier. There are many others, but those, I think, two are the main big ones.
Understood. Going back to tying the pieces with the UPI again. So I think you have been in favor of introducing charges for UPI. But before that, could you maybe tell us what is MDR? And after that, maybe can you give us, I know you are in favor of introducing charges, but could you make the case for and against, why is introducing charges a good thing and maybe why it's a bad thing? Could you maybe give us the case for both sides?
Sure. I think MDR is basically merchant discount rate, or it's the commission that is paid off as a percentage of the value of the transaction to the entities facilitating that transaction, right? So if I'm paying money to, let's say, my local chaiwala, for example, right? I'm using UPI or I'm using a digital payments interface at that time. Now, there is an app that I use. There is an app that the chaiwala uses. The entire dance between my bank account to my chaiwala's bank account, there are like four or five different steps in between, right? And managing those four or five steps in between is complex. It involves a lot of processing on the back end, and there's a lot of data storage as well that goes on in the back end. it may seem to a consumer and to us that it's all happening instantly, and you know, it looks trivial and frivolous on to us as consumers, but there's a lot happening in the background, right? And I've written a separate edition of my newsletter on just how payments works as well, right? But because there are all those entities in the background working in sync to make sure that my transaction goes through and that my payment goes successfully to that chaiwala, there needs, all those entities in the background have costs in dealing with making sure that everything goes well, right? And therefore, I feel that there should be one of those commission rates that needs to be introduced or charged to make sure that those entities that are facilitating my transaction are compensated adequately to make sure that they continue to do well in processing that payment, right? So for card networks, for example, there is a card net, there is obviously the card network like Visa, MasterCard, or whoever that are ensuring that between different banks, they are making the communication happen, right? So they are the central entity that is communicating with all the banks and created that network of banks to make sure that the transaction goes through seamlessly, right? Different banks will have different systems, and those different systems don't necessarily talk to each other in the same language. The card network is required in the middle to make sure that there is an interpreter or a translator to make sure that those two banks are communicating properly and the transaction goes through, which is why also there's SWIFT messaging for international transfers and things like that. But not to complicate things, so there has always been a merchant discount rate or an MDR that has been charged historically in India and globally also. In the US, it can be 2 to 3% even for debit transactions and credit transactions and things like that. In India, credit transactions via credit card has no cap, but it can go anywhere from 2 to 2.5%-ish of the value of the transaction. A debit transaction via a debit card has been capped to 1%, right? And then for other payment forms like IMPS, RTGS, NEFT, and things like that, RBI has just said there needs to be a cap on the absolute value. So it can be something like 5 rupees per transaction or 20 rupees per transaction. But that's an absolute value that goes. So effectively for NEFT, RTGS, and IMPS, you end up using those for very large transaction values, right? Because there is that 5 rupees that is charged no matter the transaction value that used to be charged. Now it's all made free, just to be clear as well.
Understood. Just a quick question. So who's footing this bill? Like, when let's say I'm making the payment, am I footing? And if I make, let's say, 100 rupee purchase, and if I use, let's say, the card, so am I paying, like, let's say, 2 rupees extra, or is the merchant paying, maybe taking a card from, like, who's footing that bill exactly?
Great question. Should have been clearer. But the bill has been footed by the merchant, which is why it's called a merchant discount rate. Where of the 100 rupees that has been, that is the value of whatever I'm buying, right? Let's say it's 2 rupees when I'm paying with a credit card or 2%, the merchant pays for that. So the merchant ends up getting in their bank account only 98 rupees, right? And the 2 rupees goes to the entities that are facilitating that transaction, right? But there, again, this was a while back where those MDRs ended up being a little prohibitively high. In some cases, 3 and 4%. Amex will charge like 5, 7% and things like that, right? So it depends on card networks. It depends on systems that are used. There are a lot of permutations and combinations. But broadly, it's an average of 1.5 to 2% types for credit cards. It's capped at 1% for debit cards, things like that. But anyway, so earlier when things were high, when the MDR was high, the merchant would add it on to the value of the transaction. So if the value of my product was 100 rupees, the merchant would end up charging me 102 rupees, right? So that the 2 rupees would still go to the card networks, but the merchant ends up getting the full 100 rupees in a sense, right?
And so, I would be footing the bill.
yes, the consumer would be footing the bill for that merchant discount rate or the interchange income. Now, RBI didn't like that because the RBI was like, merchants can charge any amount then over there. It doesn't need to be just that 2%. Some merchants would charge a flat fee of 50 rupees, for example, on 100 rupees or whatever those things may be. Some merchants would only accept card payments above 500 rupees, for example, not less than 500 rupees. So all of those various tactics were started to be used by merchants back then. This was, again, 2013, 14, 15, right? Which RBI just didn't like because the RBI cares about the consumer, right? And consumer rights and all of that stuff. And so RBI introduced those measures to make sure that the payment gateway is liable if the consumer is charged by the merchant, right? So the RBI said that the payment gateways need to ensure that the merchant doesn't charge over and above the value of the transaction. If they don't want to accept it, just don't accept digital payments and things like that. So there were measures that were brought in by RBI. And now I think today most merchants are comfortable with an MDR, and it's just a cost of business for the merchant, which is why you see POS devices at merchants which have average ticket size, which is slightly higher, 1,000, 2,000 rupees, where that cost of 1.5-2% is bearable by them as a cost of operations in their margins, right? With the smaller merchants, you won't see POS devices so easily available. You'll just see a QR code, which is where UPI comes in. And UPI, when it was launched in 2016, or when it was being thought of to be introduced in the country, was not thought of to be free, actually. It was just intended to be subsidized for some time, but then cost eventually was supposed to come in. And I've written this whole history in that edition that you are talking about, where because of demonetization, the government in 2016 wanted to introduce it as a way to replace when cash moved out of the ecosystem to bring in digital payments, because there was no other alternative, right? People still need to transact even if there's no cash in the system, right? And so they made it free for some time. But now, because it's been made free, merchants across the country are using it and are completely clear that UPI is free, which is why they were willing to accept UPI payments, even for small purchases of 10 rupees, for example, right? Where the entire cost is borne by the government by subsidizing all the entities that are making sure that the payment goes through successfully, right? The banks wanted to introduce UPI-based MDR. RBI was in favor of introducing an MDR or an interchange rate over there. But I think the government has steadfastly said, no, it has to be free, right? I just think that there are real costs associated with maintaining systems of such high frequency, right? If 1,000 people are making 10 rupee worth of transactions, right? And you multiply by that by the amount of seconds in a day and things like that, the load on the systems is immense, right? And so just to maintain those systems, to make sure that those systems are updated and continues to manage the scale that UPI is bringing on, there are some serious costs associated with that, right? And it's not just the cost with NPCI, it's the cost with the payment companies that are acquiring the merchants, there is a cost to acquiring the users, there is a cost to making sure that the messages that are being transmitted to the beneficiary bank from the remitter bank, all of those aspects, there's a whole dance that goes on, right? And to make sure that it all goes on in sync, a lot of things happen in the background, right? And so to incentivize the people that are building those systems, that are maintaining those systems, and that are innovating to make sure that the system scales sufficiently, right? There are costs, and those costs need to come from the MDR or the interchange income of UPI, right? But now, let's say everyone thinks that UPI is not that... Actually, before I get into arguing against my own argument, the other aspect of UPI is that, which I don't know if too many people are thinking about, but there's a lot of fraud that still happens on UPI, right? When there is a fraud on a card transaction, Me as a card holder, I can write to the card network and say that there's been a fraud over here, and they will, it's called a chargeback over there, right? There where they investigate the matter and they make sure that if there is actually a fraud, I am compensated as a consumer, right? So those aspects of chargebacks, those aspects of making sure that fraud reduces, all of that stuff is there on a card network, which is managed by a private entity. On UPI, there's no such thing as that, right? So who manages chargebacks? How do I write if there's been a fraud on my UPI account, right? How do I make sure that if there is a fraud, I'm able to write to someone and make sure that I am compensated adequately for something like that? So all of that, that aspect of fraud, chargebacks, scams, all of that stuff, right, also needs an entire infrastructure. It needs systems to maintain and to constantly keep updated and make sure that any new forms of scams and frauds are also intimidated on that platform and therefore can be managed, right? And therefore, to manage those systems,
just to push back in the sense that, but you don't think the incentives for incentives to banks to just the incentives for banks to prevent fraud in UPI is not extremely strong enough because of economic costs, is it? Like, you don't think it's inherently strong enough, is it?
No, it's assumed that that UPI is strong enough because there's a PIN that only I know of and things like that. I don't think it's just that there is no incentive for people to not build these systems and all of those aspects, because I mean, the government today is compensating it or subsidizing all of that stuff, and the government is paying for that. The RBI also wanted to launch a payment acceptance fund, right, of a certain value contributed by all the payment platforms in the country. So there were a bunch of things that were intended to be done, but that just never ended up happening. I don't think there are no incentives for banks to manage this aspect. But at the same time, none of us as consumers use a bank's app for UPI, right? And so if I am suffering a fraud attack, I have probably not used a bank's app. And therefore, it's not up to the bank and it's not their incentives to build anti-fraud systems on UPI, for example, right? I have used a platform like Paytm or Google Pay or PhonePe as a consumer to make sure that payment happened, but it was a scam payment, right? So technically, I should go to a PhonePe to make that payment. But can I really go to a PhonePe or any other platform to say that there's been a fraud on my platform or on my account and therefore I need to be compensated adequately? I don't think there is a system like that today. Well, there is a help sort of section in all these apps, but I don't know how much it is being used because there are no publicly maintained databases of the level of fraud that happens on UPI.
Oh, I have actually sent relatively large amounts to like random people by accident, and like the only option I have, I think, is just texting them via the app,
requesting for the money back. Exactly.
Yeah, bro, please, I sent it to you by accident, just send it to me back, please. So that's the only request I can make. Yeah.
Exactly. But think about this. And this happened to me, by the way. Let's say you are searching for a business online, right, on Google. Everyone searches on Google for things, right? I searched for a business on Google. I was in Bangalore. The business that I was searching for was in Delhi. So I searched for the business, and I know it's a legit business, right? But then I wanted to call them up. So I called them up, right, using that call option on Google, right? And I called up the number, properly answered about saying that it was the brand, or I mean, it was a restaurant. So I called up the restaurant over there. They said that I need to transfer 2,000 to 4,000 rupees to book my table and things like that. And I was like, okay, fine. You know, maybe a thing to do. Transferred it. And it turns out that it wasn't the number of the restaurant. It was the number of a scamster who had just uploaded their number and claimed it as their business online, right? To which I was just like,
what the fuck?
Where do I go for something like this?
Oh fuck. Okay.
And so I saved that number as well of the person or the number that I called, and even their WhatsApp image was of that restaurant. And so to what extent can I as an individual go to make sure that the person I'm calling from a Google, right, is legit? But you can't. It turned out to be a scam, obviously. But that happened to me, and I would say more advanced with regard to fintech than most other people. So it's things like that, which is why I think you need to introduce MDR or this interchange rate for payments, because there are real problems that can be faced if the entities that are facilitating a payment aren't compensated well enough, right? Because if they're not incentivized well enough, then there is no incentive to continue to maintain that system. There is no incentive to build adequate guardrails for consumers. There are a lot of challenges that come about if there are no incentives for them economically in the platform.
So I think you've laid out a very strong case for introduction of fees for MDR. So I have one argument here. One argument I came across for not introducing MDR was, UPI is a net positive for productivity of the Indian economy. If we introduce MDR, people will stop using UPI and all gains will vanish. UPI is a net... Yeah, sorry, I've just written that quote twice. So that's the end of the quote. So this is just one of the argument that I have come across. Do you want to steelman the case of if the arguments that you laid out previously, if they are so convincing, then why are people hesitant to introduce MDR? Is it just inertia that, since once it's free, it's very difficult to ask people to pay for it? Or are there other systematic reasons that people are hesitating to levy the charges?
I think what I'm trying to say is that once something is free, it's very tough to go back and charge for something like that. And I've seen this multiple times across the decade that I've been trying to work in this space, right? If a user has come onto a platform knowing and thinking that something is free, they will very easily switch out if they see that you are starting to charge them for it, right? And the main entity that will stop accepting UPI is the merchant when an MDR is introduced. Therefore, most merchants that are accepting MDR at the point of sale are small merchants or small businesses, small kirana stores and things like that, where the transaction value itself is so small that their margins are very paper thin, right? And if you add on an MDR onto that paper thin margin, they make no money. So there is no incentive for them to continue to accept UPI if there is an MDR introduced.
Yeah, before you said that, I was actually just thinking about how merchants already accept credit card or debit card, and they already accept MDR. Now that you mentioned about kirana stores, it's not feasible for them. The margins are extremely thin when it comes to kirana. But let's say a restaurant, maybe they are kind of okay with taking that MDR. But for small shops or roadside vendors, for them it would be very difficult. That's the argument you're trying to make, is it?
Yeah. And that's the majority of India, right? For UPI acceptance, restaurants aren't the majority. There are maybe a couple of 100,000 restaurants in the country, right? But there are several million small businesses and kirana stores in the country, right, where this UPI is currently accepted. Even among restaurants, for example, there are only the large ticket size sort of restaurants where they will have an actual POS machine, or you'll find one of those white POS machines, right? Very rarely will you find it for your local restaurant to have a POS machine.
To be clear, POS machine is a point of sale machine, right?
Point of sale machine, which is like your brick-like card.
Right. You enter the credit card or you tap. Yeah.
That's a POS machine. So those machines will be only at your larger establishments for restaurants, right? But other than your kirana stores, there are pharmacy stores, and there are a whole bunch of other sort of merchants where their ticket sizes are not as large. Average ticket sizes are much smaller, but more importantly, their margins are very small, right, on the products that they end up selling. And therefore, if you add on an MDR on UPI, they will just stop accepting. And if the merchants at all these millions of small businesses across India, if they stop accepting UPI, then where will the user use their UPI account, right? So there is that aspect of it as well, which is the case against introducing MDR over here. And these small businesses are very sensitive to even the slightest of or even the smallest of introductions in costs to the business.
So currently, is government footing the bill right now? I mean, for UPI?
Largely, yes. There are merchants as well that foot the bill, but in various forms. Like Paytm introduced their Soundbox and now is being introduced by all other payment companies, right? So there are different ways in which now merchants are paying for UPI acceptance, but it's not via MDR.
Initially, you made a very strong case for introducing MDR. Realistically, do you see it happening though?
No, unlikely.
Even in the next 5 to 10 years, you don't.
I hope it happens, but I don't see it happening.
Right, because I mean, when you were talking about the Kirana stores having very that seemed like a very strong point for like not introducing. I don't know. Do you think there might be a shift where like if a company makes less than X number of revenue, maybe for them there are no using such kind of exceptions might be made and introduced. Do you think we could have systems like those?
I don't think it can be done because the small business owner is very price sensitive, and therefore the moment you start bringing in these little exceptions of if you're above a certain threshold of income or if you're above a certain threshold of average transaction value or if you're above a certain, like all of those aspects, right? There are ways in which the small business owner finds ways to game the system, right? To give you the most simple example, EPF or Employee Provident Fund, for example, is only applicable to companies with more than 20 employees, right? You'll be surprised to know the number of companies that try to keep it within 20 employees just to avoid paying EPF, right? And so there are all those sort of ways in which people game the system just to avoid paying a little more, only because they want their margins to be decently high, right? And any new introductions in costs will find creative ways to get around those things. So just in my opinion, it has to just be a flat sort of one size fits all kind of MDR, whether you are introducing, let's say, 0.1% cost of MDR or you introduce like a 1 rupee MDR, right? So it should be just something very standard and applied across the board. It cannot be exceptions and all of those aspects, in my view.
But in some sense, we all are footing the bill in the sense, since it's taxpayer money, at the end of the day, the public is kind of footing the bill, isn't it? Like, is that fair?
I don't know. I don't know where the money of 2,000 crores is coming from the government. I guess it is taxpayer money. But yeah, I don't think it should be taxpayer money to be compensating for something like this.
You don't consider it as like a public utility, is it?
Yeah, it's an economic utility. It's not a public utility, right? Public utilities are completely different. And that paid for by taxpayers is fine. But something like this is economic activity. And if it is compensated for by the taxpayer, then, you know, what's stopping entities from paying for the most frivolous of things with taxpayer money, right?
Understood. I want to come back to one other thing that you said, where in passing you mentioned most of these transactions are being done not on bank apps, but on PhonePe, Google Pay, and maybe Cred. So I use Cred. Is like how did this come to be? In a sense, like, were these companies like? I mean, I would assume that the bank apps would be like, you know, would try to get market share for these kind of transactions. Like, did they kind of miss the boat on like trying to you know, sell to the consumers that, you know, do the transactions on our app, or whether UI or were the was the app of like, let's say, PhonePe or Google Pay or Paytm was just inherently better, and that kind of you know, convince the users to use that. So could you give us the dynamics there on like how PhonePe and Google Pay kind of ended up dominating this market?
Sure. Again, I can't speak for how these bank executives thought internally, but my thesis or my assessment of it is just that, by the way, these platforms which are non-banks that started to roll out UPI are all called TPAPs or third-party payment apps, right? And these platforms or non-bank payment companies now are, or TPAPs, I think in 2015-16, it was just that there was no precedent for something like this, right? For a new payment system that was being launched in the country. And therefore, I think goes back to my earlier point about banks, where banks are a little risk averse with doing anything new that does not have a precedent, right? And therefore, there was that little bit of hesitancy with regard to launching something they don't know how it will affect the bank or their users or anything like that. That's my assessment. I don't know if this is true for how they were thinking about it, which is when you saw that these third-party payment apps or TPAPs ended up launching their platforms. The other thing also was that, again, it was launched partially in a hurry because demonetization just happened, right, one evening. And therefore, the system readiness for a lot of these banks was probably not there, or they hadn't built out that that interface for their customers via their bank apps, right? Which from a tech readiness perspective was probably the TPAPs. And therefore, they were able to launch it as opposed to a bank. And then it was just everything to the moon from there on for these TPAPs.
One slight digression, in the sense that I have noted, Paytm launched, I think Paytm was one of the first companies to introduce UPI, or, you know, payment through QR transactions. But last I checked, PhonePe and Google Pay had like a duopoly in the market, I think 40-40 each. And I think Cred was number third with, I think, 3 or 5% of the market share, if I'm not wrong. It just seems confounding to me that one of the first companies that, and I think even when demonetization happened, Paytm was out there in the street with so many QR codes. What do you think happened? Do you have any theories on like why Paytm kind of fell through the cracks on?
I think, of course. I think it was fairly well known that Paytm had built out its entire brand around the prepaid wallet, right? The entire platform of Paytm was about you load your prepaid account or your Paytm wallet with so and so amount, and you can start making payments, and it's accepted via the Paytm QR code and things like that, right? And then when UPI was launched, actually PhonePe was the first ones to launch UPI. It wasn't Paytm. PhonePe was among the first platforms actually that was launched, then acquired by Flipkart, and then sort of rolled out via Flipkart, right? So that's how it happened. And then when demonetization happened and UPI was launched, again, that brand of the prepaid wallet for Paytm stuck. And the others kind of said that you don't need to load your money into a wallet and all of that stuff, just make bank-to-bank transfers, right? Which is when the other TPAPs really took off. Because at the time, there was also a little bit of backlash for Paytm, which Paytm was just not able to shake off from its brand and image and all of that stuff, which is when people just moved on to another platform. And that's what helped the other TPAPs take off.
Actually, even I can kind of sympathize with that. Even I was never comfortable like loading all my money to a wallet and then transferring. Like the ease of just like having a bank account and then transferring just seemed much more intuitive and much more convenient for me than uploading it to a wallet and then seeing my money in a wallet. That just felt a little odd for me.